I remember that trip like it was yesterday, even though it's been a few years now. I was a junior in college, studying environmental science, and our class had planned this 2-week field study in northern Florida. We were supposed to be tromping through the swamps, identifying birds and plants, learning about ecosystems. Instead, it turned into something out of a nightmare. We couldn't afford fancy hotels on our budget, so our professor booked this big old Airbnb on the outskirts of Tallahassee, a sprawling ranch-style house with enough rooms for all 15 of us students, plus the instructors. The listing looked okay online. Cozy retreat for groups, hosted by friendly couple. Yeah, right. From the moment we pulled up in our rented van, something felt off. The place was tucked way back on a dirt road, overgrown with Spanish moss hanging like creepy curtains from the oaks. The hosts, Mark and Linda, greeted us at the door. Mark was this burly guy in his 50s, with a faded tattoo peeking out from his shirt collar, and eyes that didn't quite meet yours. Linda was thinner, all smiles, but her laugh sounded forced, like she was reading from a script.
"Welcome, y'all. We got fresh towels inside, but you'll have to ask if you need extras," she said, handing over a single key ring with a bunch of identical keys. "These work on all the doors. Makes it easier for big groups like yours."
I shared a room with two other girls, Sarah and Mia. We were all excited at first, unpacking our bug spray and notebooks. But that night, things got weird. Sarah tried her key on what she thought was our bathroom door, but it opened into another student's room.
"Oh my God, sorry!"
she yelped, slamming it shut as the guys inside laughed it off. Happened a couple more times. People wandering in accidentally, thinking it was their space.
"This is so sketchy,"
Mia whispered to me as we settled in.
"Why don't they have proper locks?"
The hosts hung around a lot, which was unusual for an Airbnb. Mark would pop in unannounced to check the AC, and Linda kept offering us these homemade cookies that tasted like they'd been sitting out for days.
"You girls be careful out there in the woods," she'd say with that fake smile. "Lots of critters and people who might not be so friendly."
I brushed it off as Southern hospitality gone overboard, but it gave me the creeps. Our days were packed with fieldwork, so we crashed early most nights. But on the fourth night, around 1 a.m., I bolted awake to the sound of pounding. It was coming from the wall next to my bed, the thin partition separating our room from the one the host said was off-limits for storage. At first, I thought it was a dream, but then the screams started. A woman's voice, raw and terrified.
"Help! He's going to kill me! Please, dear God, help me!"
Sarah sat up, her eyes wide in the dark.
"What the hell is that?"
Mia was already fumbling for her phone.
"It's coming from next door! Oh my God, listen!"
The woman kept screaming, words tumbling out in gasps.
"No, please! Don't—"
Then a thud, like something heavy hitting the floor, followed by a wet, squelching noise that made my stomach turn. It sounded like flesh being torn. The screams cut off abruptly, replaced by heavy breathing and dragging sounds.
We have to call 911, I said, my voice shaking as I grabbed my own phone.
My fingers were numb. I could barely dial.
"Hello? Yes, there's a woman screaming in the room next to us. She said someone's killing her. Please, hurry!"
Our instructors, Mr. Jenkins and Ms. Patel, burst into our room minutes later, wrapped in robes, faces pale.
"Everyone out! Get to the living room!"
Mr. Jenkins barked. We huddled there, whispering frantically.
"Did you hear that squelch?"
Sarah asked, her voice breaking.
"It sounded like blood."
The police arrived in about 20 minutes, two squad cars with lights flashing but no sirens. Mark and Linda were there too, suddenly appearing from their attached cottage.
"What's all this commotion?"
Mark asked, his tone too casual, like we'd woken him over a noisy party. The cops went straight to the storage room. We waited outside, shivering in the humid night air. One officer came out looking grim.
"Room's empty,"
he said to his partner, loud enough for us to hear.
But there's blood everywhere. Splattered on the walls, pooled on the floor. Drag marks lead into the back door, like something was hauled out. Ms. Patel gasped.
Was there a woman in there? Another guest?
The cop shook his head.
No sign of anyone now, but this looks bad. We're gonna need statements from all of you.
They rousted the whole class, shining flashlights in faces, asking questions.
Did you see anyone else here besides the hosts? One asked me.
I told them about the screams, the pounding. Mark hovered nearby, arms crossed.
Must be some prank, he muttered. Kids these days.
Linda chimed in, her voice sugary.
We've had no other guests. That room's just for our stuff. Maybe an animal got in?
But I wasn't buying it. As the police taped off the area, I noticed Linda's hands, reddened like she'd scrubbed them raw. And Mark's truck was parked funny, backed up to the house with the tailgate down. My mind raced. What if they were involved? Serial killers preying on travelers. I'd read stories like that on Reddit, about hosts who lure people in. We didn't stay. Mr. Jenkins herded us into the vans and we drove to a chain hotel in town, paying extra out of pocket.
This trip's cursed,
Mia said in the back seat, her head on my shoulder.
I just want to go home.
The next day, the police called our instructors back for more questions. Turns out, the blood was human. Type O positive. Fresh. No body, but they found a woman's purse hidden under the floorboards in that room. Inside, ID for a 28-year-old named Emily Carter, a solo traveler who had booked the Airbnb separately through some off-app deal. She checked in the day before us, but no one had seen her. That's when the twist hit. While we were out in the field that afternoon, I got a frantic call from Sarah.
Turn on the news! The host! They're wanted!
I pulled over the van and we all crowded around my phone. Local station reporting, Mark and Linda weren't just shady. They were fugitives. Real names? Harlan and Rita Sykes, suspected in a string of disappearances across the South. They'd been running Airbnbs under aliases, targeting young women, luring them with cheap rates, and then, well, the details were gruesome. Harlan would assault them. Rita would help cover it up. They sold organs on the black market, or so the rumors went. Emily had been their latest victim, screaming for help right next to us. But here's the plot twist that still chills me. One of our classmates, a quiet girl named Becca, had gone missing that morning. We'd thought she was just sleeping in, but her stuff was gone. Police found her phone in Mark's truck. Turns out Linda had slipped her a cookie the night before, planning to grab her next. Becca had woken up disoriented, overheard the hosts arguing about the next one, and snuck out to hide in the woods. She flagged down a passerby and called the cops herself. The satisfying part? They caught Rita that night trying to flee in their truck. Harlan resisted, got tased. Rita broke down crying, spilling everything. Emily's body was found buried shallow in the backyard, stabbed multiple times. Her screams the last thing she managed before he finished her. Becca was safe, though traumatized. The class? We cut the trip short, flew home early. Our professor apologized a million times.
I should have vetted them better.
This story has been loosely inspired from a real story shared by one of our subscribers. This is what she said. On a college trip in North Florida, we stayed at a sketchy inn. Towels required a front desk request, and key cards weren't room specific, leading to strangers accidentally entering our rooms. Around 1 to 2 a.m., a woman screams of, "He's going to kill me!" and "God help!" woke us, followed by a sickening squelch and silence. We called 911 and alerted our instructors, then fled to their room. Police found the neighboring room empty, with blood and drag marks to the door. Our group was evacuated and relocated to another hotel for the week. I've avoided shady inns ever since. I used to think I was just forgetful. A few eggs missing, a bit less soup in the pot than I remembered, damp towels when I hadn't used any. At first, I blamed stress. Maybe I was losing my mind, memory gaps, careless housekeeping. But it went on for months. My dishwasher ran full loads even when I only ate out of one bowl. One afternoon, I found the butter dish smeared across the counter like someone used it with bare hands. It was greasy and foul. That's when I started locking the door to my pantry, like a fool trying to protect what was already gone. The truth came out by accident. I heard a sound in the attic, a low thump followed by a shuffling, almost like someone crawling. I grabbed a flashlight and pulled down the ladder. Up there, under old blankets and behind boxes of Christmas decorations, was a makeshift den. A sleeping bag, a pillow, a stack of tinned soup, and a portable hot plate, complete with charred edges on a makeshift wooden table. I dropped the flashlight. I called the police. They camped out inside my house for two nights until they caught him. A man, maybe early 40s, wiry, beard rough and patchy, climbing a tree at night like a raccoon, searching for the attic vent. His name was Darren. No ID, no known address, just a shrug and a weary look in his eyes. Here's the strange part. I didn't press charges. I told the police I wasn't frightened. A lie. I told them maybe he just needed help. Also a lie. Truth is, I didn't want people asking why I hadn't noticed sooner. Why I lived beneath someone for months without realizing. So I told them to let him go. They did. The next day, Darren showed up again. Not sneaking. Just standing in my backyard like he was waiting to be let in. "What do you want?" I asked from the porch.
"You got good soup," he said with a grin.
That night I made dinner for two. It became a routine. He never stayed in the house, always climbed back into the attic through the same old vent. I let him. He didn't ask for much, a warm meal, a quiet place. Some nights I even found myself sitting across from him at the table, sipping wine, talking about books he'd read or things he'd heard on the radio. He was oddly well-spoken, claimed he had a degree, said he used to work in tech, said there'd been a fire, a layoff, a divorce. Every night it was a new version. One night, after we'd finished dinner and the last drops of wine were gone, Darren didn't head for the attic. Instead, he came up behind me as I was clearing the table, his hand gently caressing my back. I froze, the plate still in my hand. The quiet hum of the refrigerator filled the silence.
"You're treating me well," he murmured, his voice deeper than usual, "taking care of my rest and food. But I need more."
My heart hammered against my ribs. I felt a knot form in my stomach. Disgust coiled within me. But then he spoke again, his voice soft, almost pleading.
"You're so pretty," he whispered. "You resemble Jennifer Lawrence."
It had been years since anyone had truly praised me, years since I'd felt seen in that way. The words, unexpected and jarring in the moment, lodged themselves somewhere deep inside. I stood there, plate in hand, Darren's words echoing in my head. His touch lingered on my back, warm and unsettling. My pulse raced, torn between disgust and a strange, fleeting thrill. No one had called me pretty in years, let alone compared me to Jennifer Lawrence. It was absurd, manipulative even, but it stirred something I hadn't felt in ages.
"This can't happen again,"
I said, stepping away, my voice sharper than I meant. You're
just some homeless guy, Darren. This was a mistake."
His face fell, the naughty grin fading. Without a word, he climbed the attic ladder, the creak of the steps swallowing the silence. I heard faint sobs through the ceiling that night, raw and broken. I wasn't his savior. The next evening, he returned, eyes red and swollen.
but there was a hardness in them now, a glint of anger. Before I could speak, he grabbed a coil of rope from the corner, some old camping gear I'd forgotten about. "You think you're better than me?" he snarled, his voice low and jagged. He tied my wrists, rough but not brutal, and pinned me to the couch. My breath caught, fear spiking. But I didn't fight. Not then.
I'm sorry, I whispered, playing along, my voice trembling. I didn't mean it.
He didn't answer, just took what he wanted. He was like a man starved for something more than food. I let it happen, my mind detaching, floating somewhere else. It wasn't about desire, it was survival, or maybe something sicker I couldn't name. For a few nights it continued. He'd come down from the attic, eyes still carrying that angry edge, and I'd let him. I told myself he had needs, just like I'd needed his flattery, his fleeting praise that made me feel alive again. We were two broken things, feeding off each other's desperation. I cooked for him, set the table, poured the wine. He'd eat, we'd talk, and then the air would shift, his hands finding me again. I obliged, night after night, telling myself it was temporary, that I was in control. Then came the night he ruined everything. I'd spent hours on the soup, caramelized onions, fresh thyme, a dash of cream. He took one spoonful, grimaced, and shoved the bowl away.
"This is crap," he said, his voice dripping with disdain. "You call this food?"
Something snapped inside me. The words cut deeper than his hands ever had. My soup was my pride, my small act of care in this twisted arrangement. I grabbed the kitchen knife on the counter, my knuckles white.
"You don't get to say that," I hissed, stepping closer.
His eyes widened, but he didn't move fast enough. The knife sank into his chest, clean and quick. He gasped, stumbling back, blood blooming across his shirt. I stabbed again, then again, rage pouring out of me like a flood. He crumpled to the floor, eyes glassy, the attic ladder looming behind him like a silent witness. I stood over him, breathing hard, the knife still in my hand. The kitchen smelled of thyme and iron. I wiped the blade on a dish towel, my hands steady now. A strange calm settled over me, a clarity I hadn't felt in months. "My soup," I said softly, almost to myself, "is the best." I smiled, the weight of him gone, the house mine again. My roommate John was a male model. I'm sure some models are actually nice people, but not John. The guy was an absolute jerk. He refused to be seen with me unless I wore clothes that weren't embarrassing. And since I was a struggling writer on a budget, basically nothing I owned met his standards. He regularly threw out my leftovers from the fridge because he didn't want my unhealthy food to contaminate his pre-planned meals. I could go on and on. He did 1,000 little things that genuinely made my life harder. Now, I'm not an ugly guy, but I'm obviously not a model. The way he treated me made me feel like a gargoyle. You're probably wondering why I didn't find another apartment. Well, we live in Miami on the riverfront. Housing is ridiculous here, and there was no way I'd be able to afford anything nearly as nice on my meager earnings as a freelance writer. I just had to deal with him. One night, I was walking home when I saw John and some of his model friends on the street. He obviously invited them over for a party at our place, which meant that he expected me to stay in my room and act like I wasn't there. I usually did what he asked because I'm not great at standing up for myself, but since we were all heading to the same place, I couldn't exactly hide from them. So I hurried to catch up with them. "John, hey." He looked at me like I was a homeless person asking for money.
One of his model friends asked him if he knew me.
I have no idea.
Then he looked right into my eyes, a serious expression on his face. You better hurry home, sir. The implication was clear. He wanted me to rush into our apartment and hide out in my room before he took his friends inside. I should have argued with him, but he had a way of making all my confidence disappear with a single look. His handsomeness made him that intimidating. So I walked past them and turned the corner onto the alley behind our house. The streetlight stopped working a few weeks before, so it was very dark. I was almost at our door when I saw something flash from the inside of a water drain. It looked like a piece of jewelry, and I stepped closer to get a better look. And that's when the shiny object moved. I stumbled backward. It was an alligator. Jesus! I'd seen the light reflecting in its cold, hungry eye. If I had gotten any closer, it would have attacked. Even now, I didn't feel safe. I hurried down the alley, too scared to even approach my door. I waited at a safe distance, struggling to catch my breath. And that's when I saw John and his friends walk into the alley. When he saw that I was still outside, he looked furious. He'd been distracting his friends for a while, waiting for me to hide myself. John! Be careful! John just glared. He said something to his friends. I couldn't hear it, but I heard them all laughing. Then, I saw John look down at the storm drain. He noticed the shiny object, too. Oh, God. Don't! John, please! He didn't listen. I watched in horror as he crouched in front of the drain, unknowingly staring into the face of an alligator. Then, his whole body jerked. It was too dark for me to see the alligator, but I could tell it had latched onto John's head. His body flopped onto the ground, and his arms and legs thrashed around. He didn't scream. He probably couldn't. His friends should have pulled him to safety, but none of them did. A few ran away immediately. The rest just stood there, frozen, until they too abandoned their so-called friend. I didn't realize I was running toward him until I was already there. I grabbed him by the sides and pulled him back. The alligator snapped its mouth at us, but thank God it was too big to crawl out of the drain. It could only reach the front of its long snout out of the darkness, which is why John was still alive. It snapped its jaws into his face, but didn't have the ability to clamp onto his head. John was lying at my feet. His chest was rising and falling rapidly, so I knew he was still alive. His face was a bloody mass of tissue. I was looking straight at him, but I couldn't see his features. Just lumps of flesh. I dialed 911. Hello? There's been an alligator attack. He's hurt bad. 5 minutes later, the paramedics took him away. They asked if I wanted to stay with him in the ambulance. I guess I was holding his hand the whole time. I automatically said yes. I was by his side as we sped to the hospital. Then, it was hours of sitting in the waiting room as the doctors did what they could do. None of his model friends bothered to show up. The next day, I was waiting by his bedside when he finally came to. His face was covered in bandages, so I couldn't see how bad it was. His mouth and one eye were the only parts visible.
What happened?
I told him to wait for the doctors to come in and talk with him. I didn't want to give him the bad news. His nose was gone. He lost an eye. They had to stitch up the rest of his face as best they could.
No, tell me. I want to hear it from a friend.
That was the first time he'd ever called me a friend. He certainly never treated me like one. I didn't know what to say. I've always been a shy, non-confrontational person. That's probably why I let him treat me like garbage all these years. But in that moment, I was blunt and honest. I told him everything, expecting him to freak out. His entire life was built around his handsome face, and now that was gone. To my surprise, he didn't cry or scream.
Instead, he closed his remaining eye and whispered, "You tried to warn me. I should have listened." All this happened 2 years ago. You might have heard about it on the news or read my best-selling book, The Model Without a Face. They're making it into a Lifetime movie next summer, so that's exciting. It's crazy that this whole situation has really jump-started my career. Now, despite multiple reconstructive surgeries and a very realistic-looking fake eye, John never got back his good looks. He works from home now, in a low-paying telemarketing job. We still live together, and when he's not in one of his depressions, he's a pretty great roommate. He appreciates me now. I'm the only person who doesn't recoil when I see his face. This story has been loosely inspired from a real-life scenario. In May of 2023, during a routine pipe inspection in Oviedo, Florida, municipal crews made a startling discovery. A 5-foot alligator was spotted deep inside a stormwater pipe beneath a busy street. Contractors using a robotic camera found the unbothered reptile resting calmly about 90 feet in, before it retreated another 250 feet into darkness, giving what officials jokingly called a serious side eye. This was not the first sighting. A similar alligator had been recorded in the same system earlier that year. Despite the surprise encounter, no structural damage was found. Officials confirmed the nearby Econlocachee River allows alligators easy access. The air in Yangon was thick, heavy with humidity and the faint tang of diesel from the streets below. My best friend, Sarah, and I had landed in Myanmar just hours ago, our backpacks still dusted with the grit of a 20-hour flight. We were 25, fresh out of grad school, chasing adventure on a budget. The hotel we found was a steal. $15 a night for a twin room in a city where even hostels could gouge you. The clerk, a wiry man with a nervous smile, mentioned something about maintenance on a few floors, but we didn't think much of it. Cheap was cheap. We crashed hard that night, jet-lagged and lulled by the hum of the ancient air conditioner. The next morning, we shuffled to the hotel's breakfast buffet, a modest spread of watery coffee, toast, and some unfamiliar fruit that looked like it had been sliced hours ago. Sarah, always the optimist, was already planning our day. Shwedagon Pagoda, maybe a market. I was half-listening, stirring sugar into my coffee, when a couple at the next table leaned over. "You to sleep okay?" the man asked, his German accent crisp. He was maybe 30, with a scruffy beard and tired eyes. His girlfriend, a petite woman with a messy bun, nodded at us, her face pale. "Yeah, fine," I said, glancing at Sarah. "Why?" They introduced themselves as Lucas and Anna, backpackers from Munich.
"He didn't sleep at all," Anna said, her voice low, almost a whisper. "They woke us up at 3 a.m. to move us to another floor. No explanation, just banging on the door, telling us to grab our stuff."
"That's weird," Sarah said, frowning. "What floor were you on?"
"Sixth," Lucas replied. "They moved us to the fourth. Said something about scheduled work. But it was chaotic. People running around, shouting in Burmese. We thought it was a fire or something."
I sipped my coffee, the unease creeping in. Our room was on the fifth floor, one below theirs. "Did they say what kind of work?" I asked. Anna shook her head.
"No, but it felt off. Like they were hiding something."
We didn't dwell on it.
Yangon was new, vibrant, and we had temples to explore.
But as we left the breakfast room, I noticed the clerk from last night whispering urgently to another staff member behind the desk. Their eyes flicked toward us, then away. I brushed it off. Cultural differences, maybe. Sarah and I spent the day wandering, snapping photos of golden stupas and dodging street vendors. By the time we got back to the hotel, we were exhausted, ready for another night of sleep. That's when we saw the police. Two officers stood in the lobby, their uniforms wrinkled, but official. A small crowd of guests had gathered, murmuring. Lucas and Anna were there, looking shaken. Sarah grabbed my arm.
What's going on?
She whispered. I approached Lucas.
Hey, what's this about?
His face was grim.
You didn't hear? Two people died last night. On our floor, the six.
My stomach dropped.
Died? How?
They're saying it was an accident.
Anna cut in, her voice trembling.
Something about the maintenance. They were gassing the room for bugs, pumping some kind of pesticide through the vents that are under the doors. The couple in the room next to us, they didn't wake up.
Sarah's hand tightened on my arm.
Wait, what? They were gassing rooms while people were in them?
Lucas nodded.
They weren't supposed to be. The hotel messed up, booked people on a floor they'd marked for maintenance. When they realized, they started moving everyone in the middle of the night. But they missed that couple. By the time they got to them, it was too late.
I felt sick. Our room was one floor below. If we'd been assigned to the sixth instead of the fifth? I pushed the thought away. Who were they? I asked.
American couple,
Anna said.
Older. Maybe in their 50s. On vacation, I heard.
The police were taking statements now. Their voices calm but firm. The hotel manager, a sweaty man in a cheap suit, was gesturing wildly, trying to explain. I caught fragments of his words.
Miscommunication. Unfortunate error. Not our fault.
The guests around us were whispering. Some angry, some scared. A woman in a floral dress was crying softly, her husband rubbing her back. Sarah pulled me aside.
Jess, this is insane. We could have been on that floor. We could have...
Don't, I said, cutting her off.
We're fine. Let's just figure out what to do.
But I couldn't shake the image. A nozzle slid under a door, gas hissing into a room where two people slept unaware. I kept seeing their faces. Strangers I'd never met, but Americans. Like us. It felt personal. Like a warning. That night we didn't sleep. We sat on our beds, doors locked, windows cracked open despite the heat. Sarah kept checking her phone, reading about pesticide poisoning. It's not just bugs, she said, scrolling. Some of these chemicals are heavy duty. They can kill you in minutes if you breathe enough.
Stop,
I said, my voice sharper than I meant. You're freaking me out.
I'm freaking myself out,
she shot back.
Jess, this wasn't a mistake. How do you forget people are in a room? How do you not check?
She was right. It didn't add up. The next morning we packed our bags. We weren't staying another night. At breakfast, Lucas and Anna found us again.
You're leaving?
Lucas asked. Yeah, I said. This place gives me the creeps now. Anna leaned in, her voice barely audible.
We talked to a maid. She said the hotel's been cutting corners for years. They use cheap pesticides, stuff banned in a lot of countries. And get this, they knew the sixth floor was booked. The manager told the maintenance crew to go ahead anyway. Said it'd be fine.
My blood ran cold.
That's not an accident, I said. That's criminal.
Lucas nodded.
The police are investigating, but good luck. This place, money talks. They'll probably pay off whatever they need to.
We checked out an hour later, our hearts pounding as we handed over our keys. The clerk avoided eye contact, his nervous smile gone. Outside, Yangon buzzed on, oblivious street vendors hawking noodles, monks in saffron robes gliding past. We found a new place to stay, a guest house run by a kind older woman who spoke broken English. That night, safe in our new room, Sarah and I talked it over.
We should do something, she said. Those people, they had families. They deserve justice.
I agreed, but what could we do? We were just two American girls, halfway across the world. This story has been inspired from a real-life incident shared by one of our subscribers. This is what they said.
In Yangon, Myanmar, we snagged a budget hotel upon arrival, discounted due to ongoing floor maintenance. We slept soundly and met some German guests at breakfast who had been abruptly relocated overnight. Turns out, their floor was slated for bug extermination via gas pumped under doors, killing two people in the adjacent room before staff realized the booking error. We were on a safe level, but the near miss has haunted me ever since.
My boyfriend Ken broke up with me about a month ago. It came as a huge surprise. I thought we were really happy together, but he said that he hadn't been happy for a while. He explained that his family disapproved of our relationship, but I knew that was a lie. I never even met his family. One of the biggest adjustments I had to make was figuring out how to live alone. I grew up with a big family. Then I moved into the college dorms. Then I moved in with Ken. For the first time ever, I was now living alone, and I didn't like it. I had trouble falling asleep. Every single noise in the house would wake me up. I spent hours lying in my bed, worried that some criminal had broken in. My oldest sister, Pamela, told me to try sleeping pills, at least for a couple weeks. I didn't like that idea, but after 3 nights of barely any sleep, I decided to give it a try. After ordering takeout for dinner, I got ready for bed and took my first sleeping pill. It seemed to work instantly. I was completely knocked out, and I didn't wake up until close to 10 the next morning. I felt really well rested, but as I got ready for the day, I remembered the strange dreams I had throughout the night. I dreamt that Ken had come back and just wandered around my house, running his fingers along the wall and staring at me from the edge of the room. The dream seemed so vivid, I could only assume that it was the result of the sleeping pill. I went to work as normal, and when I came back home that night, I tried the sleeping pill once again. Like the night before, I fell asleep right away and had the same strange dream. In my dream, I was lying frozen in my bed while Ken walked around my room, staring at me. Even though I've gotten pretty good sleep for both nights, I decided to stop taking the sleeping pill. I didn't want to keep dreaming about my ex. So the next night, I went to bed naturally. Not surprisingly, I could not get to sleep at all. No matter how long I stayed lying in my bed, my brain wouldn't calm down enough for me to sleep. I just lied there with my eyes closed. But then, in the middle of the night, I heard footsteps inside my house. I knew I was still awake, so it wasn't another dream. This was real. I opened my eyes just a little bit and saw a figure walk into my room. It was Ken. That's when I knew that my dreams from the last 2 nights were real. Ken had snuck into my house 3 nights in a row and I had no idea why. He wasn't stealing anything. He wasn't trying to contact me. He was just walking around. I shivered under my covers. I was terrified. I didn't think that Ken would want to hurt me, but I also didn't know why he was trespassing. I laid there frozen and waited. After about half an hour, Ken casually walked out of the room. The next morning, I decided to find Ken and confront him. I needed answers. So I drove to his family house, where I knew he was staying with his parents and brother. Then I knocked on the door. Ken answered right away and he seemed surprised to see me. I demanded to know what was going on, but he just looked at me like I was crazy. He had no idea what I was talking about. I told him that I'd seen him sneaking around in my house at night. His eyes got really wide and he looked terrified. "That wasn't me," he said. "I know it was you," I said. "Why are you doing that?" "You can't stay there anymore," he said. "Get out of that house, now." He was going to say something else, but then he stopped. Someone else had just entered the room behind him, but I couldn't see who it was. He told me that I had to get out of there, and then he slammed the door in my face. After that, I was more confused than ever. I didn't follow his advice though, and I went back to my house. I refused to live in fear of my ex. I went to bed as usual, and I did not take any sleeping medicine. This time though, I kept my phone under my pillow. As soon as I heard anything, I'd call the police. I stayed in bed and waited for any noise. I didn't have to wait long. Just after sunset, I heard footsteps in my living room. I pulled out my phone and dialed 911. As the footsteps got closer, I whispered into the phone that someone had broken into my house. I gave the lady my address and then hung up the phone just as my bedroom door creaked open. I watched through half-closed eyes as Ken once again walked through my bedroom. I could see him touching my things and opening my underwear drawer to smell what was inside. I prayed that the police would get there soon. Ken walked closer to my bed. He watched me for a long moment before slowly reaching down to touch my shoulder. All I could do was hold my breath and pray. I felt his hand slide along to the top of the blanket. Just then, sirens blared from outside. The police had arrived. Ken jumped back and then raced toward the window. I watched as he dove out the window and tried to run away. After he was gone, I heard two gunshots and then silence. With the police just outside, I got out of bed and looked out the window. I saw Ken lying dead on the ground, two bullet holes in his stomach. Several policemen had gathered around him. One of them noticed me looking out the window and walked over to explain what had happened. He said that they caught my intruder trying to escape and they had no choice but to shoot him. They asked if I knew who it was, and I told them that it was my ex-boyfriend, Ken. But when I looked closer at the body, I realized that it wasn't Ken at all. It looked like him, but he was shorter and fatter. His eyes were darker too. That was when another car pulled up to my house and the real Ken came out. He ran toward the body and then wailed in sadness. "You killed my brother!" he screamed at the police. Ken was completely freaking out, and the police had to handcuff him before he'd calm down. I went outside to find out what was really going on, and Ken finally explained the truth. He never wanted to break up with me. The only reason he did was because his younger brother Carl had become obsessed with me. I never met his brother before, but they looked so similar that I'd mistaken them for each other. Carl had just been released from a mental institution, had seen photos of me, and then started following me around. Ken thought that breaking up with me would make Carl lose his obsession, but it only made things worse. I felt so sorry for Ken. Even though his brother was a psycho, he didn't deserve to die. Over the next few weeks, Ken tried to reconnect multiple times. I always turned him down. I didn't know if he wanted to get back together and restart a relationship, but I wasn't interested. Every time I saw his face, I picture his brother quietly walking through my house at night.